Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The census has been much in the news lately. Though now a ritual over 200 years old, it continues to provoke controversy over its accuracy in the past and just how to do it in the future. In a moment, we'll take a look at the history of the census with historian Margot Anderson. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1638, the first feminist of the New World was banished from her community and denounced as a heretic. Anne Hutchinson was declared a threat to both the Puritan leadership and traditional gender roles that admonished women to be meek, obedient, and passive. She challenged Puritan teachings on the means of salvation and even on her right as a woman to discuss such issues in public. For that, on March 22, 1638, she was excommunicated from her church and ordered to leave Massachusetts. Hutchinson and her family moved to Rhode Island and then to Long Island, where they were killed in an Indian uprising in 1643. Turning to history in the news, he may have been a daring general, our first president, and currently guardian of the $1 bill, but George Washington has a serious image problem. Being a founding father may make him important, but it does not make him popular, or more importantly, cool. The directors of Mount Vernon, Washington's historic estate, have therefore assembled a media and marketing team for the president and declared 1999, the bicentennial of his death, a campaign year to revitalize the first president's image. The $3 million public relations campaign aims at bringing out the other side of Washington, the architect, the environmentalist, the entrepreneur, and hip fashion figure. Organizers hope that through well-packaged press kits, festivities, books, websites, and theatrical productions, the public's perception of Washington will be improved. George Washington's image is not the only piece of American history in need of new packaging. In Washington, D.C., scientists, engineers, and designers, and archivists have begun constructing new encasements and frames to protect the original parchment Declaration of Independence, Constitution, and Bill of Rights. Brittle with age and in danger of deteriorating, if not more carefully stored, the documents will soon be sealed in airtight cells of inert argon gas and framed in special titanium, aluminum, and tempered glass. The documents, often referred to as the Charters of Freedom, are one of Washington's most popular tourist attractions. You are listening to Talking History. Though now a venerable American tradition, the census continues to be controversial, both over its alleged inaccuracies in the past and over proposals to change the process by which it is carried out in the future. The U.S. Supreme Court has had its say, we will continue to count heads for the apportionment of seats in the House of Representatives among the states. But the Clinton administration plans to have it both ways, count heads for apportionment and use sampling techniques to provide a second set of figures. Here to provide some historical perspective on all of this is Creighton's Dennis Mihalik, who will be talking to Margot Anderson. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. Recently, congressional Republicans sued the United States Census Bureau to prevent it from using a counting technique called statistical sampling. To place the dispute in historical perspective is today's guest, Dr. Margot J. Anderson, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, and the author of the book, The American Census, A Social History, published by the Yale University Press. Welcome, Professor Anderson.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin with the obvious. I mean, exactly what is statistical sampling and why is it controversial?
Statistical sampling is the technique of counting a group of individuals out of a total population, in other words, a representative, randomly selected probability group or sample of a total population in order to draw inferences about the total population that it is drawn from. Your second question is why are we doing it or why is it controversial? It is controversial because of the use that sampling would be made. There are questions that have been raised over many years, primarily in the last 30 or 40 years, about the accuracy of the census, which of course is a complete count. We try to find everyone every 10 years when we count the population.
Okay, so historically, how did the Census Bureau go about counting people?
Historically, and this is true all the way back to the first census in 1790, the federal government sends out enumerators, or in the early period, they were assistants to the United States Marshals, to walk or travel every single neighborhood and byway of the country and find everyone at their known residence or known place of abode, their what is called the usual place of abode, and then to total up all those answers and aggregate it back to the national population.
So you mean they would have to hire thousands and thousands of people?
Yes, hundreds of thousands of people, yes.
Well, where would they find these kinds of workers for, you know, a few weeks?
Roughly, yes, for a perhaps a few months, for once every 10 years. We have, that has often been said, assembled an army close to it every 10 years to count the population. More recently, we used the mails, and most people respond by mail, but even then, we still hire many, many people. And that process is actually underway now, not in the actual counting of people, but certainly of the identification of every single residential household in the country, some 100 million of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, a simple question. I mean, why do we keep counting people every 10 years?
We count people because in the 1787 Constitution of the United States, the framers needed a mechanism to allocate political representation among the what was then 13 states, and of course, which is now 50 states. In other words, we needed to figure out a way to determine how many congressmen went or came from each state. And the framers decided that it would be based on a count of the population. In other words, we would allocate House members on the basis of population, and to do that, we had to count the population every 10 years.
I see. Well, then, since now we have these mathematical techniques and we're so used to all these survey polls and so forth, why not just use statistical sampling?
Well, the sampling that is being proposed for the 2000 census is not proposed for the basic population count, but rather as a correction or a completion method. In other words, no one disagrees with the notion that it is the duty and the responsibility of the federal government, and actually it is also the legal responsibility of every household to provide a population count every 10 years. So we will do that just as we have in the past. What is different this time is a more elaborate effort to, in fact, capture, to make sure we've done it properly. In that sense, sampling is a check upon, or almost what I like to call sometimes a double counting. We are, you know, ideally you'd like to count the whole population twice, but that's actually logistically impossible. So we are suggesting that we'll count a sample twice and use that to see how well we did with all, you know, 275 million of us.
Well, I mean, 275 million. If you miss a couple of million people, what's the big deal?
And that's a very good question. The big deal is not that you miss a few people here or there, but that we miss differentially the same kinds of people. In other words, if we could be pretty much assured that it would be that we would randomly miss or even overcount, for that matter, the individuals, and that was not aligned with other demographic characteristics of the population, age and sex and geographic location and so forth, then it wouldn't matter. But it turns out that the undercount is differential, that we count, for example, the suburbs better than we count the cities. We count older people better than we count young adults. We count whites better than we count non-whites. So that and since the numbers, once we do count, are used for both political apportionment and the allocation of federal funds and for a whole host of other issues, we get a kind of inaccurate picture of the demographic character of the nation because certain groups are counted better than others.
So big city mayors and leaders of minority organizations would be in favor of the sampling? Am I correct?
That's the way it works out politically. It's sometimes a very interesting group of people who shift. They take one position or another. By and large, the way our both apportionment and allocation formulas work is there's a sense, generally accurate, that the more the better. In other words, the more people you have, the more money or power or whatever it is that you get. So that what people are really concerned about is the undercount of those, you know, of your particular group or constituency or whatever. It's often a case, I mean, these days, one of the areas that are hardest to count are the very rapidly growing areas in the Sun Belt of the United States. It's called the Sun Belt, from the South and the Southwest, places where there's large numbers of immigrants, but also areas that are just generally what demographers call demographically dynamic. In other words, a lot of people moving in all at once, and that makes it a little harder to find. In other words, the Bureau is out counting, listing addresses right now. Well, they also have to go back right before 2000 and make sure that some new development didn't go up since they came around in late 1998 or early 1999.
I see. Now, I mean, are there laws involved here that will bear on this case before the United States Supreme Court?
This issue has always tended to be controversial, and the census has gotten tangled up in political controversies many times over the last 200 years. So from my perspective, my long perspective as an historian, what the arguments that are going on now are not terribly different from ones that developed in the past. What we're dealing with right now at the moment is a difference of opinion, a fairly strong one, between the Republican House of Representatives and to a lesser extent the Senate, but the House is really taking the lead on this, and the Democratic Clinton administration. Each side sees their way as the right way to take the census, and essentially have been arguing over it for the last few years. The interesting thing, from my perspective, is that what is often called the Clinton census plan was actually put in place either in the Bush administration in the early 1990s or in the early Clinton years, when it was not really a very high priority. In other words, there really wasn't much political interest in, which tends to be the case in the middle of the decade. Not many people worry about something that's 6-7 years out. But once the House of Representatives and the Senate went Republican in 1994 in the context of a Democratic administration, each side has taken opposing positions on how this should work out. They have, in fact, been not able to compromise either legislatively or sort of administratively. So what they have done is passed through the appropriations process a kind of expedited judicial review of this. And so there are now two cases that are working their way through the federal courts. They're actually at the Supreme Court. And in November 30th, 1998, there will be hearings. To get the court's opinion on whether sampling is a legitimate census method, both constitutionally, legally, and so forth.
I see. Okay. Now, as we've been talking, the census counts people.
Right.
Well, I mean, why does the census ask so many questions? I mean, the form is pages long.
Well, there's actually two forms, and in fact, the form you're referring to is a sample. That only 17% of the American households will get that, what is called the long form. In other words, the one with all the questions. Most people get one that's short and that only has six or seven questions, admittedly, for each person. So if you have five people in the House, you may, you know, you're filling out five pages, but it's one for each person, you know, six questions for each person.
I see. Now, in these basic questions, why the questions about race and ethnicity?
The questions of race and ethnicity, unfortunately, go back to our, you know, right back to the very beginning, and again back to the Constitution. The United States created a apportionment system, which, at least during the antebellum period, at least until the Civil War, required that the slave population of the United States be discounted, once they were counted in the census, to 60% of the value of a white person or a free person for the purpose of allocating political representation. Now, that requirement, which was in the Constitution, it's called the Three-Fifths Compromise, led to the census being required to ask a question on race, in other words, that you had to know whether you had to be able to divide the population into slave and free. And that very quickly became a decision to count the population by race.
I see. Now, in my own research, for example, in 1900, I've worked with this long-form census.
Right.
And people could identify themselves as mulatto.
That's right.
But they no longer can.
Right.
Who makes up these categories of race?
The categories themselves, at least on the census form, up through about the 1960s were, let me back up a sec. Actually, Congress wrote the census form in Congress until the 1920s. Believe it or not, they actually sat every decade and decided whether we would ask about ethnicity or literacy or whatever it happened to be. In the 1920s...
My favorite was, do you have a flush toilet?
Well, and that comes later, right?
Yes.
Because flush toilets come a bit later for
yes.
a large portion of the American population.
Yes.
After the 1920s, the Congress decided that that was a function that the Secretary of Commerce and the superintendent or the director of the Census Bureau could best handle. And that was where that, and those officials now do, by and large, make those decisions. But in the 1970s, the federal government, through its sort of central statistical agency, which is actually what is called the Office of Statistical Policy and Standards in the Office of Management and Budget, decided to try to standardize across the all federal agencies race categories. So now our racial classification is an official one, right, which was there was one developed in 1977, and there was one recently revised in 1997. And that's a very long answer to a short question, but those are the people that, in fact, do it. Right, and the
okay, and of course it is extremely controversial. I see that they have just published their list of categories again, and already people like geneticists are claiming that these categories don't exist and shouldn't be used, and so forth.
Yes, and the review process for the race and ethnicity categories that were promulgated in 1997 actually started back about 4 years earlier, and there's a voluminous literature on it. By the way, one of the other issues was whether you could have multiple racial responses. Up until this decade, if you answered, you know, if you checked two boxes or tried to say, well, I'm actually, you know, Asian and Indian, you were forced to identify with one or the other. The new innovation, and this gets back to your question about mulatto, the answers to the race and ethnicity questions in the census and on other surveys are answers of self-identification. In other words, individuals get to decide who they are and what they are. And as a result of the review process and the new Office of Management and Budget categories, which is called what they call OMB 15, people can also check more than one box. That, I think, will lead to some interesting demographic results after the 2000 census in particular, and lots of fodder for scholars and the public generally to talk about what are Americans' racial identities and what we think about that question.
Dr. Anderson, that is all the time we have.
Right.
And as we can see, the census is and will remain to be a controversial thing far beyond simply counting the number
right.
of people. I would like to thank our guest, Professor Margot Anderson, for her interesting observations about the complexities of counting the population of the United States.
Thank you.
Also in the news lately is the now 30-year-old U.S. embargo of Cuba. Standing nearly alone in the world in its policy toward Cuba, the U.S. has come under increasing pressure to lift the embargo. The Clinton administration has eased restrictions slightly, but how much further the United States is willing to go remains to be seen. Here to provide some historical perspective on the Cuban embargo is Henry Ryan, an associate of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy. Ryan is the author of The Fall of Che Guevara, a story of soldiers, spies, and diplomats.
President Clinton just eased the U.S. embargo of Cuba slightly, but no one seems pleased. Many Cuban Americans think relaxing travel, trade, and other restrictions helps Castro, and so is dead wrong. But other Americans increasingly want to dump this very old embargo. President Eisenhower initiated it in 1960. President Kennedy strengthened it in 62, both hoping to topple Castro. Those were Cold War years, with Washington at loggerheads with Cuba and the Soviet Union pouring billions into the island's ailing economy. Cuba was training revolutionaries from around the world and trying to spawn Marxist insurgencies wherever possible. Kennedy responded with a hapless sabotage campaign, bungled attempts on Castro's life, plus a disastrous CIA-backed Cuban exile invasion in 1961. And a tougher embargo. Then in October 1962, he learned that Castro had Soviet missiles able to destroy U.S. cities. The result was the famous missile crisis. But today there is no Soviet Union. Russia stopped subsidies to Cuba in 1991, and Castro certainly can't foment revolutions. Still in 1996, he handed U.S. hardliners a trump card by downing two Cuban American airplanes near, but not in, Cuban airspace. Long after that, no U.S. politician dared think about easing relations. That year, Clinton signed the Helms-Burton Act, toughening the embargo and making it law. But early last year, Pope John Paul II changed the picture. Visiting Cuba, he criticized the embargo, thus encouraging moves in the U.S. to end it. Shortly after, Secretary of State Albright hurried first to Miami to discuss policy changes with the fiercely anti-Castro Cuban community there, then to the Vatican. Next, President Clinton took a few wary steps. He allowed air travel to Cuba for Cuban Americans, permitted them to send money to relatives there, and allowed medical supplies to go more easily. Last month, he increased air travel, began mail service, eased delivery of farm products, and agreed to games between the Baltimore Orioles and Cuba's national team. Many Cuban Americans see these moves as appeasement, even though they help members of their community. On the other hand, U.S. businesses, once shrill Castro critics, backed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, want to be able to do business there. Also, the embargo infuriates our allies because it calls for U.S. action against them if they invest in Cuba. Furthermore, groups with humanitarian concerns, like the National Council of Churches, say the embargo mainly hurts those Cubans with fewest resources. Today, Castro is a toothless tiger internationally. Let's end the embargo, especially as it hasn't toppled him in nearly 40 years.
You've been listening to Henry Ryan, associate of the Georgetown University Institute for the Study of Diplomacy, and this is Talking History. Americans are fascinated with politics, especially presidential campaigns. For this week's Site of the Week, we've selected a museum that provides a history of presidential campaigns. And here to tell you about this museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Museum of American Political Life, located at the University of Hartford, has several permanent exhibits to keep visitors busy. The history of presidential elections covers an entire 70-foot wall of the museum and provides a constant point of reference for the visitors using a massive display of campaign artifacts and hundreds of graphic and photo images. The wall illustrates the relationship between politics and noteworthy trends and events in our history. A 10-minute film on the history of political campaigns introduces visitors to the museum's main themes, which include the right to vote, log cabin to White House, perennial political issues, reform and protest, and the presidency in the press. The Museum of American Political Life explores the history of American politics and presidential campaigns. The museum is open Tuesday through Friday. It is free, but donations are suggested. For more information, find the Museum of American Political Life at the University of Hartford's website at hartford.edu.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, where we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of historical nature that may be of interest to you. Paul Robeson, All-American football player, Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Rutgers University, and world-renowned actor and singer. Perhaps one of the most talented Americans of the 20th century, was also one of the century's most controversial figures. An African-American who spoke out against American racism and with admiration for Soviet communism at the height of the Cold War, Robeson was the subject of intense public criticism and governmental surveillance. You can now learn more about this fascinating figure through the National Portrait Gallery exhibit, Paul Robeson, Artist and Citizen. The exhibit runs through April 18th. For further information, contact the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. And while you're in Washington, check out the new exhibit, The Jesuits and the Grand Mogul, Renaissance Art at the Imperial Court of India, 1580 to 1630, at the Sackler Gallery of the National Museum of Asian Art. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week when we will examine the war in the Balkans. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. I'm gonna make it.